Yes. So, I am going to talk about mapping the humanities business ground up. This comes out, actually, of work I've done with Japanese, Korean, and Chinese colleagues, where we wrote, actually co-edited in Japanese, a history of Japanese, but also of East Asian comparative literatures. And you realize very quickly, once you go beyond the 19th century, back in time, that notions of literature that come out of the Western tradition just don't match. And you either can use the Western categories and then have a lot of footnotes, or you can try to actually find indigenous, more resonant concepts that actually give you a more integrated access, no, to these knowledge cultures. And that's exactly what we were doing with that literary history. Now, since this morning we've been talking about the business of the humanities, we got a strong mandate from, or you know, pressure from John Wilson, our keynote address speaker, that we are the people who should be saving the world now. But we haven't really talked about what humanities are. And I don't want to do this in the typical way. You go to the Oxford Dictionary to see what the humanities are. That's, of course, the move that will kill any type of answer to this question. So what I'm going to do is to look at three little snapshots. I want you to understand the humanities as actually kind of a phenomenon that's anthropological, that's part of human cultures, and that takes different forms in different time periods and places. And even as we speak now in this country, depending on the institution, you might have history as a social science or as a humanities. All of these things have actually, there's a lot of diversity there, no? So when Tristan and Alex, who can't be here today, and me actually wrote up this introduction to our manifesto volume that I mentioned in the opening, no, this is what we said here. We cannot not hear that the humanities are in crisis, retrenched, and I love that from MIT, outstemmed, demoralized, but we're also hearing the humanities are resurrecting, blossoming in unexpected corners, becoming seriously public, critical to this critical moment. Until a decade ago, for decades, the outcry was crisis. Now we have the luxury to ask, which humanities? Adjectives abound. Public, applied, old, new, medical, environmental, digital, positive, planetary, global, even blue. I love that. Maritime humanities. This proliferation of qualifiers signals vitality, but also a frantic quest for new semantic framings of an old European protean noun. And this is exactly one of the challenges we are facing. The current challenge is that we're talking about the humanities as this universal thing, but we're actually only talking about the humanities, what they have been, you know, basically studia humanitatis out of the Greco-Roman tradition, no? And that really doesn't work. We have to build up humanities in capital as studia humanitatis, all the traditions that came out of kind of Greco-Roman, of the Greco-Roman world, plus a lot of other traditions, no? And now here is the game. This is kind of half tongue-in-cheek, perhaps we can do it next year. We have a makerspace time tomorrow, no? Which is for filming and so on. But yesterday when I came into the airport, I thought, yeah, I always love these things like welcome in so many different languages, no? This one is a little bit better because at least welcome is a little bit smaller. It's not like the Anglophone tyranny eating up all the other languages. And you also have actually other directions of writing. The awareness, Wayne, you showed us, no? Of actually the other scripts, other ways of writing. But I thought, what about making a map of humanities traditions across the world? We could really get our hands dirty on the ground, big, big, huge canvas, and we could be doing this together. Now, I just want to give you a few ideas for where to start. So obviously, this part we all know well. Studia humanitatis, this was actually a term that comes really out of late antiquity, basically. And you see it has flourished in different languages here that continue the idea in blue of actually studies, no, in Greek, epistemis, or epistemis, Wissenschaften in German, Dutch, and Then the other one in green has to do with humanity in some way, no? Anthropistikes, humaniora, very interesting. In Norwegian, they use the Latin word still, no? Humaniora or humanistiske Fag. Now, German and Hungarian is interesting because they introduced the Geist, the mind, the spirit, especially in the 19th century, very Hegelian, no? And in some ways, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that's why the Hungarians use Bölcseskor, which means the wise or the wisdom and the mindful kind of studies, no? French has an interesting combination here, actually, with letters. So patterns that have to do with, that are human created, no? In many ways. So this tradition we know, of course, well. Now, if we go to East Asia, we have here Chinese and Japanese, no? Dimbungaku and Renwenshue and Imunhak, Nanwanhok. So Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese. You have this idea, and this goes back to also to Tristan's talk. He talked about the patterns of the earth. But there's also there the patterns of the heavens, of course. Look at them tonight. And there are patterns of humans, Renwen, no? And the patterns of humans are, is actually what nowadays you call humanities. It's patterns that are specific to humans. For example, writing, for example, forms of governing, you know, all ways of being human in the way Otto talked about it, no? In many ways. And that's very much at the basis of this term nowadays. Now here you have Arabic and Persian. You have Elm or Ulum Ensani. Sorry, I have a Persian kind of pronunciation, and I know there's an Arabist here. And Ensaniat, no? So actually the knowledge or the studies of humans, no? That's the modern term. Now, you think we're actually done if we do that exercise. Oh, no. Oh, no. The real challenge actually comes now. Because these modern institutions, they are completely crypto-colonial. These are terms that, although they stem from their original indigenous kind of traditions, that are, have been adopted as translations of actually basically humanities, no? In English or whatever languages, Western languages. What we need to get at is actually the traditional key concepts, no? In the East Asia, this will be human pattern, and it included actually much more broadly literature, history, philosophy, and I'll show you an example of what other things it included that we wouldn't be thinking of as humanities or literature. And in the Arabic Persian, on the one hand you have ilm, no? Or ilm in elm in Persian, ilm in Arabic, and that is actually knowledge of God. Now, in the Islamic context, which in some ways is very strange to use that for human knowledge, nowadays, human kind of sciences, no? But that's the term being used. And what's much more important is where really the tradition of what you could call humanities in the Islamic world comes from is adab, no? Which means refinement, decorum, humaneness, actually in interesting ways, also similar to wen, which precisely means patterns of animals' fur or, you know, tattoos on humans, but means precisely civilization. Also, it's at the bottom etymology is what nowadays is also civilization, literature, writing, and all these kind of things. And also, actually, King Wen, or the cultured king, who is the virtual model, so to speak, in Confucianism, no? So in many ways, makes much more sense to compare East Asian notions of humanities and adab here than anything about God's knowledge, you know, of the humans. That's just a colonialist translation, basically, that we're using now. And then we have to take another step on our big map, namely to ask, who were these people who were humanists, so to speak? And I consider that so important because there are like kilometers, I think, of bookshelves written about the humanities and debates here and there, whatever. But the important thing is to ask, who were these people in their time? What were they serving? Whom were they serving? What were the institutions that were supporting them? Because then we can actually think about ourselves. What is it for us nowadays, no? And there it's really interesting. I just gave you here, you know, this is like a very tiny little bit. For example, for East Asia, you have here Ru, the traditionalist. This is almost like before Confucius or up to Confucius in the 5th century BCE. Then they, in the Han Dynasty, around the Common Era, the centuries, they become the kind of philosophical school of the Confucianists. No, this is the Ru Jia. Ru Lin, these are in the Han Dynasty, the Confucian officials who are serving in the government, no? Not just philosophers, they're serving in the government. And overall in East Asia, you have this concept of Wenren, no, or Bunjin and Munin, the literati, so to speak, who are often connected to Confucian learning, but they can take very different forms. In Japan, they are more like academicians. They are not very important in government. People look down on them, but you know they do scholarship. In Korea, as part of the Yangban elites, no, you have actually the so-called Sonbi also. You have the Yangban who are in the city. They're the Confucians who are in Seoul and who are kind of the bigwigs. And then you have people who are called Sonbi who are in the countryside. Or there might be bigwigs who retire to the countryside and who really try to live a Confucian ideal of simple living, no? Very simple and frugal living. And that is very specific for Korea as a very Confucian country, really going back to these ideals. Very different already in East Asia, no? And then just one little thing that I always enjoy, when you hear humanism nowadays or think of like Renaissance humanism, it sounds very elite-like, but it was actually kind of a jargon term and a joke about people in the 15th, 16th century who were, about students who were studying Greek and Latin grammar, no? Oh, these humanisti, no? Oh yeah, he's an humanista, no? So in that sense, it originated from that actually, no? So this is just a tiny little bit of what would go on our chart, no? Here you see wonderful, you know, charts by Diderot and Alembert from the Encyclopédie. You will really need to do that for all kinds of other traditions. And now I want to give you these three little snapshots to make you aware what thinking we need to do in terms of where people do humanities work, where they should be doing that work, and so on, in our time today. So Kyoto here, 800, Göttingen, 1830, this is in Germany as a university town, and then Boston 2024, that's our initiative, basically. So Kyoto 800. 6 years ago, the Heian period began when the capital was actually moved to Kyoto, what's now Kyoto. What did the court do? Under somebody called Emperor Saga, who was very powerful, he sent actually students of Buddhism to China to learn cutting-edge knowledge. What did they bring back? Kukai, very famous. He brought back Shingon Buddhism, a very important form of Buddhism that actually protected the imperial house. And he also brought back a lot of knowledge about poetry, which might strike you as strange, but because Buddhist recitation was so important, it was very important to understand how actually the Chinese were pronouncing Buddhist scripture, and in that sense, Kukai collected a lot of what we know now nowadays know about Tang Dynasty Chinese poetry comes from Kukai's kind of what he brought in his suitcase, no, from China. This was a time where precisely the emperor was very powerful. This changed as we went through this century, and we get to somebody called Sugawara no Michizane, an amazing guy, also deified. It actually connects very well to Orr's talk, but not so much an animal. He was actually part of the Sugawara clan, which had been private tutors, no, to actually the founding emperors of the Heian period. Private imperial tutor, he was then professor of the lineage here, that was the great-grandfather of Su Michizane. They were professors at the Confucian Academy, and they also had their own clan school that they actually opened. Now, some things that are very special about him is precisely that he also became a god. The god of the humanities that you pray to. I'm going to show you actually the images here in a moment. God of the humanities, if you ever go to Dazaifu in Kyushu in southern Japan, or you go to Kyoto, go there, write on this little tablet with Michizane and his plum trees, I want to make it into Dominican, I want to make it into MIT or whatever, Seoul National University. You go there and people write this down and they pray actually for their exams and so on. So he has about 2,000 to 3,000 shrines in Japan nowadays. Isn't that awesome to have a God for the humanities, no? God bless his heart. So, in this context, what's this snapshot about? The humanities here are a courtly hereditary business. The Sugawara family, the Oe families became the hereditary clans who would be doing scholarship. They would be professors at the academy, so they are lower aristocracy, not so powerful. Michizane himself was banished by the powerful Fujiwara clan, and after that they were never politically powerful, just as scholars, no? And they would be teaching this curriculum here of classics, history, literature, law, math, and would also be Confucian ritual officials for the Confucian rites twice a year, no? And one of the things I remember when we were writing this literary history was that the problem is these humanists, so to speak, they were writing genres that nowadays we would be like, oh my God, how boring. You would never bring that into the Norton Anthology of World Literature, you know? You cannot not sell a single volume. Edicts, state council decrees, exam essays, petitions, encomia prayer texts, and so on, sponsor wishes. So they produced a lot of texts that are actually hard to read, also kind of boring, but so important. That was their function as humanisti, no? In the 9th century in Japan. Let's go on, and I know I'm already almost out of time, to the two other snapshots, and then I'm going to wrap it up. Is that okay, Tristan? Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Let's jump to Göttingen 1830. In 1776, Göttingen University, which is now right in the middle of Germany, was founded as an Enlightenment university. Very important because, unlike a lot of other even universities founded at the time in Central Europe, it didn't have an important theology faculty. But it was a secularized Enlightenment university. And I want to point out here one interesting figure. This figure is called Karl Ottfried Müller, and he was a very famous classicist who really revolutionized classics, but unfortunately died while copying inscriptions in Olympia whatever they called it. He was treated by the royal physician of King Otto, who was from Bavaria and thus German, and he was the only one who died. Everybody else who got that kind of fever didn't die. They didn't get the royal treatment, so don't get the royal treatment if you can get it. That's what you learn from him. But what is important here with him is he came from a family of Lutheran pastors and theologians. His fields were like classical philology, art history, archaeology. He learned a lot of that art history from actually plaster casts at the time. That's how you would learn it. You wouldn't go to Greece. Greece was just recently actually freed, so to speak, or changed from being part of the Ottoman Empire to actually having a Bavarian king. His jobs included being a high school teacher, writing a habilitation like the second book nowadays. He was professor also of rhetoric. He was part of the Academy of Sciences and a counselor in the government and a classicist architect. I'm going to show you that in a minute. These are his publications. And the very important thing is that he was the first to say, guys, Greece used to be a place where you can go. Don't just look at it and in the texts. He promoted what's called Sachphilologie, or things, the philology not just of words but of things. So he went there and he took a huge expedition with him. This is actually, my hometown is Göttingen, so that's a statue of him there. And what do we see here as a snapshot of the humanities at that time? This was really the high point of old European humanities, a little bit what Otto described too. In this, a little, this was actually before Humboldt, but leading up to that. You would be part of the government, he was at a secularized Enlightenment university, and very importantly there, you could say like classicists, who cares nowadays, the guiding discipline, especially since theology was gone or not important, was really the study of Greco-Roman philology. That was actually the study that, as Otto mentioned, the Bildungsideal, the self-formation, self-cultivation, that's what made you human, no? Although it was just written by some Greek and Latin dudes, basically, you know, from a long time ago. But in that sense, this is really the core of the Geisteswissenschaften, or the humanities, in many ways. And he kind of stepped out of that by saying, let's do some empirical field work, actually. So here you see, actually, if ever you go to the Kolonos in Athens, where the Platonic Academy used to be, that is his burial there. And I was recently, this is the classicist building he built that still stands in Göttingen. And I was recently contacted by the Academy of Arts and Sciences in Athens, because they want to do something in 15 years, it's down the line, for actually the 200th anniversary of his death, no? But in many ways, he was a total pioneer in his own time. Now, very quickly, you have already heard about the global humanities. Let me see. So I don't need to say so much. now, but I want to really alienate everybody, including myself now. Institutional setting, basically a global Western-style university. We have done a good job. Or colonial kind of military and governments have done a good job to force the world to adopt the Western model, no? We don't have madrasas, we don't have Confucian academies basically anymore. That's where we are now. Education counts as a cultural capital, no? There's a global higher education market with foreign students, world rankings, and all those pressures. And it is the age of humanities, humanities in an age of STEM, where we can say crisis, we can create new humanities, we can talk about transformation, that actually ought to also do transformation literacy, or, and I recently heard that at MIT, and I find it very alienating, holistic STEM. We would be gobbled up by STEM, we are the holistic adjective, the kind of nice adornment, no? We really don't want that. And the MIT landscape, and this is not MIT just, it's really, you know, the US as a whole and in many other places too. We had this foundation of this new collaborative that I talked about this morning, but it's basically a lot of these kind of foundations of centers or collaboratives are part of an administrative-driven, equity-focused university that does not necessarily look, most importantly, like what are the big questions, what are the big challenges we need to solve, but more, do I use the right language? Do I actually give everybody the same and not more? Or things like, you know, do I have the administrators in place to make sure everything that I'm saying, you know, is happening? And that's a huge challenge nowadays, too, as faculty, that I think we really want to focus on the problems, but a lot of the ways to do bigger things and big thinking are really channeled through administrators. I'm not saying that the administrators are the problem, but the system that actually puts them into that kind of action, no? So here's the figure Tim the Beaver for that. I'll kind of end here now. So we need to move, as I said, from thinking that what we think the humanities are, and that's mostly a Western discussion, or in Western languages, to something that is the treasure house of human experience, the treasure house of actually coping with challenge in this world, in different times and places, where we can learn so much. And that's exactly what we want to go for when we make the map, but also in general. So the exercise here I put you through was really to hone historical self-awareness. Self-awareness was so important today in so many talks, no? To ask, what age of humanities tradition are we actually in? Where are we in that development, no? Then cultural self-awareness. Where are we coming from? Where are other countries and humanities traditions coming from? What can we learn from each other, no? What can we learn from ancient Confucian academies? They're still actually in Korea and also in China to some degree. They're actually having a boom right now. And diagnostics and goal setting, and that's something I will be talking more about at the roundtable too. We have here this humanities crisis, and in many ways, the diagnostics of what the root causes really are haven't been done in many ways. That's, I think, also where humanists can kind of contribute. And based on that, looking at our current crises, looking at communities' needs, no, we can then go on to design or prototype in Otto's language the humanities for our moment, no, the 21st century, and in all their diversity as they currently exist around the globe. Thank you.